Today is the 13th of September 2006, and we are visiting with Carl Killian. Carl, tell us how you came to be in Houston and how you came to know at a fairly early age some of the arts and the artists and the art scene.
I grew up in Houston. I wasn't born here, but we moved here when I was two or three. My mother's family had been here for a while. They were interested in art, more interested in music. My connection with the Dimmonils came completely sort of flukishly. George and I were in a carpool. Do you remember the Polar Wave Ice Palace? Have you ever heard where everyone used to go and ice skate? We were in a carpool together when we were probably in the sixth grade. But I laid out of school for a semester in college and came back to Houston. And my sister, who was here, and her roommate, Helen Winkler, who was in the art history program, said, because I was going to spend a summer in Belgium, that there was a class in Netherlandish painting that was being taught by a woman named Jeanette Favreau. I signed up on that, and everyone said, hey, you know, you shouldn't be taking that course. You should be taking the survey that's being taught, the survey of art being taught by Germaine McKagey. So I did both. That was the second semester of my sophomore year. Jerry died at the beginning of the, right at the end of the first semester of my junior year. But in the meantime, it was a small group of people, and the Dimmonils took sort of exceptional interest in some of us. And we just began to be friends on our own, as well as students and so on. And then I worked for Dominique, I guess, on a couple of shows while I stayed at St. Thomas and graduated from there because of the art history program. And then I went to New York to go to the Institute of Fine Arts, where I ended up not going, at NYU, to Washington Square to get a graduate degree in English. But I continued to work for Mrs. Dimmonil on several of her exhibitions, so we stayed in touch there as well.
What kind of work were you doing for her on those exhibitions?
Some of it was help with writing. For a person who writes or who wrote very well, she was a little insecure about her English. She always wrote in pencil. You could see where she'd been because there was a little pile of eraser dust under the on the floor on the table where she was. But she would ask me to research things, write letters for her. One of the most entertaining stories about it was I worked with her on an exhibition called Made of Iron.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked some time in Houston and then went to New York to work, and it annoyed her that she sometimes, walking into a gallery, would confuse bronze with iron. She would ask about a piece, and she didn't want the person from the gallery to have to say, well, that's really not iron. So she gave me a pair of tiny pocket magnets, and we'd walk into the gallery, and she would nod at a piece that she wanted, disappear with the gallery dealer, and I would go over and see if the magnet stuck, and if they did, then the conversation would begin about that. And to her, this was something that she both was serious about, but also that was very funny, too. So, like everything I said, nothing was conventional.
Well, Carl, going back into your memory, describe how Houston was from an art standpoint for you in the 50s and 60s, the city itself.
I've got, in a way, two memories of it, what there was when I was actually there, and then how I learned more about it, and the two are sort of inextricable now, doing that exhibition for Bradley's Projects, which was about Houston from 1950 to 1965. For example, when I moved back to Houston to begin school at the University of St. Thomas, Helen Winkler Fosdick, who'd become a friend by then, and some others took me to an art gallery to see the work of an artist that they liked a lot, and it was the Catherine Swenson's gallery, and it was Jim Love's, maybe his second or third show there. And that really kind of threw me into this. Jerry McKagey, because she was so much involved in so much of that, also was sort of a conduit in which I was not only aware of what she was doing right then, but would learn about what she had done earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition, this would be a little bit later, Rick Barthelme was a close friend, and his older brother Donald Barthelme was the director for a year of the Contemporary Arts Association when it was still in the A-frame building, and a guy, Jerry O'Grady of all people, organized for him a film series at the Prudential Auditorium that I think Fred Hughes and I attended just about every one of. So kind of depending on who you were or how much work you wanted to do for it, there was a lot here to see and to do.
Mm-hmm.
St. Thomas, at the moment that I was there, was really kind of the nexus of all of this. I mean, if you look at the openings of one of Jerry's shows or later one of, well, really more Jerry's than Dominique's, everybody went there because it was probably the only thing that was going on that night about the arts, but it meant that you were kind of in the middle of things.
Mm-hmm.
One of the nicest things about that period was that it's not that it slowed down, it's just that it hadn't gotten that fast yet, and you had opportunities to talk to people which we'd probably never have had now.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Fred Hughes, who became a friend in the sixth grade at St. Anne's School, was always interested in art, and his grandmother would give him for Christmas lessons at the museum school, which then was in the basement of Cullman Hall. And I would go with Fred. The assignment was to go upstairs in the museum and look at the exhibition that was there and write something about it and draw something about it. It was Totems Not Taboo. And obviously that was, it was extraordinary. It's really extraordinary. And Fred and I remembered that. We walked around a lot together, you know, sort of looking at architecture and so on. And St. Thomas was a place that was interesting to us because it was modern. It was sort of my first experience with the Mesian aesthetic. And because my sister was there. And so we went upstairs to, part of this was trying to see where what Jerry McKagey was doing other than that, because we heard that she was at St. Thomas. So we went into the art department and sat down, and Louise Ferrari was there, and we began having a conversation with her, and it was late in the afternoon, and Louise went to the back and called Jerry and said, you know, you're not real busy. There are a couple of guys out here who seem pretty interested in what's going on. Why don't you come out and visit? And Jerry sat there for easily an hour, maybe more, and I think that was one of those transforming moments to Fred. He probably would have gone to St. Thomas anyway. But it was something that might not have been able to happen even 10 years later when five phones were ringing and all of that. And,
right.
And it was one of those moments. What I remember though about the new art gallery, as it was called, was that Catherine was great, not as, she talked for information, and she talked in a very sweet and engaging way, but that sort of playfulness, that very, very intellectually based playfulness that Jerry had, you wouldn't sit down. I just didn't. I mean, and I don't mean this as a reflection on her at all, but we went to New Art because I love the building that Bailey Swinson did. I could never quite figure out what was the house and what was the gallery. Sometimes Catherine would take us around and show us. She was very generous about that. But everybody was so, to my mind, grown up then. You know, everyone wore a jacket and a tie and a shirt, and you dressed up for art the way you dress up for church or for work or anything else. But you got the feeling. We didn't know that much about Dominique in the early days, except that there was this sort of tan jaguar that meant that she was there. She was at St. Thomas, sort of switching around a little bit. And that she also was very good friends with a wonderful priest named Edward Lee, who taught in the English department and who almost daily cooked for people and would have guests over for lunch. And I think he was part of what drew the Dimonils in. It wasn't just St. Thomas. There were these other, I mean, it wasn't just the art department. All that, of course, was key.
Mm-hmm.
But we got to know more about her. I mean, Jerry did what she did with Louise And the Dimonils, I guess, could have been in those years they traveled a great deal more. This is before she became so focused on something that would keep her in Houston a lot of her later married life.
You're talking about Mrs. Dimonil there.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
What was describe Jerry McCady, the kind of person she was.
Well, she was an oversized individual. There's no way of saying it other than that. It's astounding to think that she was 50 when she died. So I guess she must have been 46 or 7 when I met her at first.
Today, yeah.
Yeah, it's just getting going to us these days, right?
Uh-huh.
She was welcoming. She taught wonderfully. She really did everything there at St. Thomas that now whole art departments would do. She built a book library. She built a slide library. There was an exhibitions program. She did talks. Her talks, I guess they began with Giotto and sort of moved forward, that she delivered from these legal pads, which I saw after she died, really were, I think, maybe the first serious art history classes taught by a PhD, which McKeggy was one of the first women in America to get, in Jones Hall at the University of St. Thomas, which is where all the classes were as well. But those, the city turned out because that's sort of, it was the only game in town, really, in some ways, as were her openings. I mean, Cullinan Hall was there, but I really don't know. I couldn't speak for what the museum itself was like. I mean, I know more about it after Sweeney came because the Dimonils brought him as well. James Johnson Sweeney.
Right.
And a director at the Guggenheim immediately before he came to Houston, and before that at the Museum of Modern Art. Jerry invited people to hang around. She loved being a center of attention. She had these two dachshunds that were with her all the time. Jerry and the dachshunds being carried, usually.
And at school.
Jerry would hold court at lunch. Conversation was welcome, and she really encouraged you to do it. And there was a game that she did. I hadn't been there long enough to take a couple of her programs. One of the classes that she taught was called The Art and Painting, and the book that she used was Albert Barnes' book of that very name.
Mm-hmm.
And she talked about, used Barnes' terms like plastic memes and his definitions of how color worked in space and all of that. And it was a big deal to get into that class. There were only three or four people. And I asked her if I could sit in, and she said yes, but you were not allowed to say anything. And she, when the class was over, maybe during class, devised this game in which she would be a painting and you were supposed to guess what it was. And in this game, you would say, if you were a symphony, what would you be? And I can remember one day, it was a Rubens painting, that wonderful painting called, I think, The Rape of the Daughters of Lysippus. And I think Fred finally got it, but the question that gave it away to him was, if you were a piece of furniture, what would you be? And she said, a piece of Bentwood furniture. And that was perfect for Rubens. There had also been a piece of music, if you were a play, you know, all of that. I mean, she was encouraging this sort of open-mindedness, sort of free play of the brain in every way that she could.
What do you think was so special about her? Because her exhibitions were, I mean, they're still talked about.
Right.
So many years later, 40 years later. What do you think it was in her, what were her gifts that enabled her to mount exhibitions that were so powerful?
Well, when she got a theme, and I think the Dimonils helped with this. I can't support this entirely, but my sense is that one of the things that makes the Manil collection interesting, even more interesting and special, are the works that are included, particularly in the Surrealism galleries, that were bought for Jerry's exhibitions, like in the Wonder Camera. That section is called Awakenings, is that what it is?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the installation that Paul and Ted Carpenter did of an accumulation of objects that were collected or attractive to the surrealist painters because these were things to their mind that opened the imagination.
Mm-hmm. Do you think she and Mrs. Dimonel collaborated on ideas for themes for exhibitions?
I don't know. I mean, I imagine them as sort of business meetings in which Cherry would go to Dominique and say, I'd like to do an exhibition on flowers, and here are some of the pieces that I've thought about. And then because the Dimonels traveled so widely, because they were buying a lot themselves, I think that they helped pick out things, you know, suggested to Jerry that maybe they could buy. I'm thinking, for example, of an exhibition that she did on Cubism called Art Has Many Facets,
mm-hmm.
in which there's a set of very sort of cubist, you could call them that, playing cards made out of whale bone or plastic, or I doubt that it's plastic, something. And also those sort of very M.C. Escher looking things of two intertwining wooden staircases. Do you know that?
Oh, yes, I've seen that.
I think that might have been bought for that. I think those might both have been bought for that. Smaller things, things that were, I don't know if you'd even call them decorative arts, maybe everyday arts, or Jerry was very interested in geometry. I think she loved the way shapes, forms intersected and all of that. But it was as magic to Mrs. Dimonel as it was to everybody else when the cartons with the cases began to arrive. And she stood there and stuck her head in front of everybody else who was watching Jerry install the exhibitions. And I think that she was a very attentive, and she had sort of the eye herself, Dominique did,
mm-hmm.
and had been working on it for many years, looking, buying, working with Jerry, working with John Dimonel. And her inspired sort of imagination or visual instincts that she had and really honed them watching Jerry.
Mm-hmm.
And Jerry became very serious then. I mean, she was very quiet. I mean,
you mean when she was installing?
Yeah. I mean, it was a serious deal. She didn't mind you being there, but you didn't touch and you didn't ask questions and you gave her a lot of room. I think that probably because she had this great visual instinct and memory, that she just collected images in the way that somebody might do, but on a much less professional level, or that's not the right word, but for maybe slightly different reasons. You choose the colors and what you wear, you choose things for the way they look, a piece of furniture. I mean, to Cherry, it was all about arrangement. She saw everything in terms of arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
And did you ever go to her house?
I never knew her. When I moved to Houston, she was gone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it was an interesting mix of things that reflected in many ways her friendships and her economic status. Jerry would collect something that was a shape that maybe reminded her of a Cycladic piece or reminded mm-hmm. her of a tribal arts piece that she then either couldn't afford or didn't, whatever. But these other things, it's not that they were surrogates, it's just that in their way, they had the same beauty that these other things
mm-hmm.
did, and probably for very similar reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And the catalog that Dominique wrote to commemorate McCaigie after she died, she talks about McCaigie, said, you know, she was an alchemist. But the first thing I think that I ever saw that Dominique wrote was when they showed their tribal art collection at the Museum of Primitive Art in New York, and she called it in her introduction the most sincere art that ever was, meaning I think that, well, you know what that would mean with them, I mean that there was a basic something that I think Jerry saw as well.
Mm-hmm.
But having been in California with her then husband Douglas, she knew Rothko and Gottlieb and some others, and she's brought some very interesting early work by those artists to the Manil collection. It was kind of divine clutter, in a way.
That's a nice way to put it.
Yeah.
It's a nice way. What were you doing when you were working, doing different things with Mrs. Dimonel? Were you helping with writing and editing? Or?
Yeah, some research. I mean, she had me look for some pieces. And for the Maid of Iron show, she asked if there were things that I had in mind that she might add, and I found some what I thought were very beautiful pieces of sort of vernacular art,
mm-hmm.
Signs, old plows, you know, things like that, some old gardening tools. She'd ask me to read things or would give me books to look through to see if there were works that we thought were something and that they might be able to borrow.
What are your memories of the Institute for the Arts at Rice?
I was away for almost all that period. But it was a step up. I mean, it's interesting. It's not that the Dimonils were not deliberate in what they did, but a lot of what they did was in response. I don't think they might have done on their own. For example, when Bill Campiel tells an interesting story. You know, he had just been hired by Jerry. He came to work in the art department, and she died in the first 2 weeks. And that really galvanized Dominique. I mean, she decided that instead of just helping fund and support this art department, that she would run it. Bill probably told you this. He would take care of the academic part of it, and she would take care of the exhibitions program and bring in the guests and all those other things that needed to be done. She said, and I'm sure other people will quote this to her, that she might very well have been happy to stay at St. Thomas, but John Dimonil, we never talked about Black Mountain, but I can't believe that that wouldn't have been a model to some extent of what an art school could be like. And his concern at St. Thomas was because there was a fairly proscribed series of both religion and philosophy courses that it was going to keep potentially interesting students from coming into the university. And he said to the administration that they really needed to drop those things, or maybe they would not stay at St. Thomas, and I think it stunned them that the priest said, see you later. So that just those two things brought them into the art department and then sent them to Rice. And then at Rice, there were things that, I mean, as they got closer to their mission, I think they realized that they really wanted to do it on their own, not having to explain anything to anybody. When the Rothko Chapel didn't go on the St. Thomas campus, then it went on, because they've been buying property. I mean, that's, I'm sure, one of the reasons that the museum is where it is, was they bought a lot of property for the University of St. Thomas.
Right. I think that's correct.
To help that grow.
Mm-hmm.
At Rice, it seemed like there was a necessary next step. And I know that there was talk at one point about when the Shepherd bequest was made to Rice, that there would be perhaps a Louis Kahn-designed fine arts building where there would be a Rice Museum and there would be the Shepherd School of Music and there would be something else. And I think they just didn't want to be partners in anything anymore. They wanted to do what they wanted to do.
Carl, as you think back in time to the 50s and 60s and even the early 70s too, what artists sort of stand out and which artists did you seem to get to know better than others?
The ones who were the closest friend would have to have been Jim Love, just because he was so intimately fond about, and I don't mean that in a purient way, he was just so close to Helen Winkler and Paul Winkler and others. I mean, we spent a lot of time with Jim. We'd go to Galveston on the weekends, and Jim and Vicki Hayes, his girlfriend at the moment, and or we would go over to Truxillo and spend a lot of time sitting around there drinking, talking. Louise Ferrari would be there. Jim was just, you know, great fun. In a more distant and formal way, I knew Richard Stout because he had taught Fred at the museum school. And then, of course, got to know Richard better when he married Ann Winkler, right? And we all played volleyball together. You know, do you ever know that?
No.
In the side yard of a house I rented from the Dimonils. Marvin Watson, the AGs, Bill Robinson, a funny group of people. Tom Sims, you may not have known him. People who were part of the original Institute for the Arts and the Media Center. And so I got to know Richard in sort of a different way there. Later, when I moved back to Houston in 74, although I had known them, before that, because I would come back here for the summer, sometimes I got to be good friends with Frederica Hunter, and that introduced a group of contemporary artists who were not necessarily from Houston. Catherine Swenson was the most interesting for me, and her daughter Germaine, whom I got to know also on the 50s show, said that her godmother, Germaine McCaggy, had been very involved in Catherine's things. What I hadn't known was that Catherine Swenson opened as an outpost for
Andre Emmerich,
mm-hmm. and that they had a conversation about that she became less showing the beautiful tribal arts and things that he had and began to show local artists, that those were not the artists that he showed in New York, and that got confusing. And then, missing a beat, she took the sign that said Andre Emmerich and turned it over and said New Art Gallery, and everything just sort of continued the way it was. Later, when I came back to Houston after being in New York for a decade, it was really sort of a great moment of the arts then. I mean, I opened on Bissonnette to be near the Texas Gallery, and in the meantime, Janie Lee opened there, and then Marvin Watson, and then others, and then Barbara Cusack. And I remember, as we thought about it, talking one day, that Janie Lee was the only person who, of the serious gallery dealers, who had not had a connection with the Dimmondills. Barbara had worked for them. Obviously, Frederica had worked for them. Marvin had some connection, which I don't remember. Maybe sort of the big four or five, just seeing how their influence pervaded. I think one of the great moments in Houston then was the Cusack Gallery. I mean, I don't know if Barbara sold very much, but it was great in the middle of all the rest of that to see Carl Andre shows and Richard Tuttle shows. And
where was that gallery?
That beautiful building on the corner, one-story building on the corner of Bayard and Berthia. Catter-corner to the white building, which is directly behind the CAM. If you go in there, it's very high-ceilinged, one-story.
Lovely.
With this beautiful doors that pull mm-hmm. out of the walls. And mm-hmm. you go in there, in the middle of all that, and the place itself is so lovely. People would go in and look for the art, and I remember once, you know, they would say, well, what is this stuff? And it was pretty minimal, but that was quite great. And Janie was a good neighbor, and the guy who briefly was the manager of the gallery, Lawrence Miller, I met at a party one night and told him that I moved to Houston to open a bookstore, was looking for a space, and he actually found the space where I was. And Fred and Ian were there, and who else? And then the Cronin Gallery opened across the street from where the bookstore was. And mm-hmm. then when the Texas Gallery left their space, Danny Clayton moved in.
I remember that, yep.
And was doing not only his beautiful frames and art at restoration, but in that little room on the side, doing some shows.
Now, that was in the 70s.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Susie Khalil, remember when Susie was at the Texas Gallery? I remember going in there and holding my first Bryce Martin. And I bought probably, you know, a significant number of small, low-budget items
mm-hmm.
there, and I really learned a lot from them. But Susie was fun about it because she was so enthusiastic, and she'd pull out a piece and say, hold this, and that was a great moment.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So
those were sort of 50s memories. I mean, sorry, 70s, sort of late memories. And then seeing what Dominique was up to also, I mean, because John DeMille died right before I came back here. And Elsie had gone to work for her by then, and we sort of stayed in touch,
mm-hmm.
socializing. I feel